Thursday, 8th of June, and following the Article 9 of GAC operating principles, the GAC appointed Ms. Heather Dryden from Canada to serve as an interim chair and a non-voting GAC liaison to the board for the remainder of the current chair's term, which ends at the end of the first GAC meeting of 2011. And this appointment is effective from June 25, which is from Friday, and Heather will be reading the GAC communique and sitting as a GAC liaison on the board meeting Friday morning. So that is what I would like to tell you at the beginning, and if you want to take it forward at this stage.
Thank you, Yanis, and good afternoon, GAC members and community. First of all, yes, the agenda has been agreed between us, and thank you very much, Yanis, for kicking that process off. It makes it a great deal easier when we've got an agreed agenda. Can I just come to the Heather Dryden appointment and congratulate you both? I think the GAC's done a very good job in selecting Heather, and Heather's doing a great job in accepting that position. There's a significant work burden associated with chairing any of the ICANN constituent parts, the GAC included. So thank you very much, Heather, for assuming the burden of work that's about to fall upon you. We all look forward to working with you, and particularly myself personally, if there's anything I can do to help, let me know. Congratulations. Yes. And congratulations also to the GAC on achieving 58 participants at a meeting. That's an extraordinary achievement. One of the key requirements for a strong ICANN is a strong GAC, and obviously solid participation by a large number of countries is a very good indicator of the strength of the GAC, so well done. And finally, while I'm making an opening statement, perhaps I can congratulate you, Yanis, and just confirm in front of your peers, your fellow GAC members, the view of the board, which is that you've been an absolutely excellent GAC chairman from what we've seen, and what we have seen in your role as a GAC liaison. You've done a superb job. We've had a very harmonious relationship with you between the board and the GAC, and between you and I personally. And I think that's contributed to a great deal of progress and better understandings and better work done between us. So the board wishes you particularly well in your new role. Thank you very much for your service to ICANN. Back to you.
Yeah, thank you, Peter, for kind words. My favorite saying is, which can easily be translated in the context of your last intervention, is that it is very good with you, but it is much better without you. Right. So I accept that, because this is my favorite saying. But don't worry, I'm not going overly far, because in my next life, I will be in charge of implementation of UNESCO ICANN agreement from UNESCO side, and be sure that I will be pesting ICANN with the requests of money and projects. But humor aside, we have a long agenda and important questions in front of us, and let us start with them. First item on the progress of the joint working group, board GAC joint working group, and I will ask Heather, one of the co-chairs of the working group, to kick off the discussion.
Thank you, Yanis. My co-chair from the board side is Ray Paulzak, so I assume he's in the room, and he will leap in as need be. In essence, the joint working group met on Sunday morning and focused on two particular issues contained in that draft report. The first is concerning GAC advice to the board, and the second is regarding the various GAC liaisons that exist. So that would include liaisons to the board, to the nominating committee, and the issue of liaisons to the other supporting organizations and advisory committees within ICANN. What we hope to do is to have those particular sections ready to submit this week, and that's in particular in response to the issues that were raised by the review team and their interest in receiving advice as early as possible from the joint working group, because, of course, these issues pertain directly to some of the questions they have related to the GAC. So I will focus the comments on GAC advice to the board. We had quite a vigorous discussion, and if there are questions around some of the GAC liaisons, then perhaps I can respond to those, but I will focus on GAC advice to the board. So what the joint working group proposes, to note that any explicit advice in any written form in the view of the joint working group constitutes the advice that is foreseen in the bylaws. There are various kinds of written advice, of course. So we note some of those in the report: communiques, letters, principles, documents, and so on. We also note that there is verbal advice provided to the board via the GAC chair, and that in that role, the chair is expected to represent GAC views. We recognize, however, that there is a need to comment on more mundane procedural matters, and so we recognize that here. We also will note that the bylaws only reference that the GAC provides advice to the board, so there isn't mention of the other communities, which in essence means that only the board is obligated by the bylaws to respond to GAC advice. We also point out that the bylaws reference in particular public policy advice, and not formal advice. I think in the past, the board has sought to clarify with the GAC whether advice is in fact formal or not, but this is not something that we see in the bylaws and isn't particularly meaningful for the GAC. So clarification on behalf of the board might be a useful way of understanding why that is of significance to the board, if in fact it still is. We also note that the majority of the advice that the GAC generates is public policy. This is the reason why we participate. This is the reason why we attend GAC meetings. However, there is another kind of advice that the GAC does provide from time to time, and that relates to the effectiveness of procedures at ICANN for facilitating interactions between the constituencies for the sake of developing policy. We also note that the policy development process at ICANN, by its nature, is iterative. So we do need to provide advice in stages. Of course, as information becomes available and GAC members have time to reflect, then we respond and issue advice as needed in relation to that process. We also refer to the fact that the GAC seeks consensus first, and this is recognized in one of the GAC operating principles, which says that first the GAC will work towards consensus, and failing that, then we must present a range of views if we cannot reach consensus. We also discussed on Sunday that generating this kind of consensus takes time, and that there is, to some degree, a trade-off between arriving at consensus and how much time there is to generate advice. We also note that as the GAC continues to expand, as participation increases, that we can expect it to be more difficult to arrive at consensus. Regarding the bylaws that describe the board obligation to notify the GAC regarding issues that have a public policy aspect to it, we note that there is no register of this, so it's not entirely clear to us how or when this aspect of the bylaws is used. But we also note that usually the GAC, in fact, reacts to initiatives elsewhere in the community. The bylaws also refer to the GAC's ability to recommend a public policy process, and this has not been used. In terms of the board process that is undertaken when they receive conflicting or potentially conflicting advice from the community, it does appear it's not clear to the GAC, and so perhaps further clarification would be useful there to understand what the process is in that case. It does, however, appear rare that the board applies this bylaw. The part of the bylaws that describes what must happen when advice is rejected. Then the draft report describes four recommendations in relation to the various findings that I've just described. First of all, the recommendation is to create a transparent register or consistent record to make apparent whether, when, how the board has taken into account or responded to particular advice from the GAC. The second recommendation is that the board could consider submitting written regular requests for advice to the GAC, clearly identified as such. This approach could also be a useful component of the proposed register. Third recommendation, in the event that the GAC decides to form a working group to review the operating principles, that the work that work could draw on the work of the joint working group. And finally, a recommendation to identify consistent methods of notating written GAC advice. That's it.
So thank you, Heather. Ray, would you like to add something to this report? No. Peter, would you like to react?
Well, my first reaction is to say thank you very much to the members of the Joint Working Group. I suppose the second reaction is to say we look forward very much to receiving the report, and I'm just not sure whether it would be productive now to respond to Heather's oral description of it, but I'd be happy to talk about any of those topics if you want to. I'm just not quite sure what would be useful in the context of not having had a chance to read the report.
Canada?
It might be useful to note in this context, whether you choose to respond or not, that one of the main issues that came up in the joint working group in some of the responses that the board provided to questions that were asked by the joint working group, that there was lack of clarity on what constitutes GAC advice, and a concern that so many years into the existence of the GAC and ICANN, that such a fundamental thing should be unclear. So it generated a very good discussion, which I think is positive. I think it's useful to flag that to you.
To which the obvious sort of instant reaction is that's because if it is advice, it has consequences, occasionally quite complicated and possibly expensive consequences. So if the GAC is just explaining what its view on something is, or if it's saying that it has a feeling about something, or if the GAC wants to say it doesn't like something, or that, you know, there's a whole range of emotional or other expressions that may be made, which we want to hear this. This is all useful information to get, and it shapes the decision making on the board, and the same kind of information can be conveyed into the ACs and other SOs. So it's a matter of, if you like, being protection for the GAC, that you that this special category called advice then triggers, you know, bylaw consequences. I don't think it's the, I don't think it's the GAC's advantage personally to have everything you ever say to the board treated as advice, because it triggers consequences. That's the first reaction. That there, lots of times you may want to tell us things that are very useful information, but doesn't actually constitute advice, which then triggers this consequence. But that's just a reaction. So everything, the major reaction to information coming from the GAC is to consider how it affects the policy development process. Was that helpful?
Body language says that not really. So, United States.
Just a quick question, and my apologies to Heather. I didn't certainly don't want to run away with any of your prerogatives as the GAC vice chair and now interim of this particular group. But I wonder, as Yanis so eloquently put it, body language says no. What might be helpful is perhaps to have a better understanding or even a legal decision that can define that word. Because the word advice, it is in the bylaws, and if we could understand how you interpret that word, that might help us understand why there's apparently been a sense that you were never sure that you've ever had advice from us in 11 years.
Well, let me be clear both by body language and by words that there are occasions when it's been perfectly clear we've had advice, when we've had a written letter from Yanis from chair to chair saying the GAC views on this are these. That there's no question about that. It's slightly different, though, when we have a discussion like this. Is everything that's said here from the GAC, advice to the board? Your communique, which often people say, well, that's advice, but the reality of a communique is it's an announcement to the community about what you've been doing at your meetings. Not all of it's directed at the board. So I think some clarity around this is probably going to be helpful.
So any interventions on this point? Dennis.
Well, may I suggest that we, the board, take an action to propose a working, a suggested definition of advice to try, if that's helpful, to try and move this forward.
Thank you, Dennis. Jean-Jacques.
Thank you. To go along the lines suggested by Dennis, one additional consideration, which I brought up during a meeting of the joint working group co-chaired by Ray and by Heather, was that I indicated that as far as advice is concerned, I think that unanimous position is, of course, more easily dealt with by the board than a series of options or positions. It's only a partial question to your question, a partial answer to your question, but unanimity, of course, makes it easier to not only take it as advice, but also to treat it in an efficient way. It doesn't exclude the expression of opinions, diverging opinions, but then we cannot consider it necessarily as advice to act upon.
Thank you, Jean-Jacques. Gonzalo?
Thank you, Janice. May I suggest that maybe this is not an issue about definitions, but processes? So maybe we can, if we identify a process, for example, exchanging letters, or a formal process to identify whenever we have an advice, a clear advice from the GAC to the board, could be easy to engage into a discussion about the definition about this particular word.
Thank you, Gonzalo. France, and then European Commission.
Thank you, Yanis. Without pushing the discussion too far, because we already had very interesting interaction and this is an ongoing element, I would go along the previous comment. It's not about making a clear definition, like something that would have a very precise frontier, this is advice, this is not. the nature of the GAC as an advisory body makes it so that, by definition, anything that comes out of the GAC is considered as no more than advice if you take the literal element. This is a different question from when the mechanism of back and forth explanation between the GAC and the board is being triggered. There is a specific provision that requests that the GAC, the board explains when it doesn't follow GAC advice, the reason why, and so on. So these are two different issues. Any transmission to the board from the GAC can be formulated in either very strong language or very light language. And obviously, whether the GAC says the GAC unanimously, strongly opposes the board doing X, Y, Z, or whether the GAC says, in the course of the discussion, we want to highlight the importance of that topic, it's a difference of degree, but according to the bylaws, it remains an advice in any case. The question, therefore, becomes not, as Alvaro said, a question of definition, but a question of process. So the key question is, when and under which conditions is this mechanism of back and forth triggered, and when is the board has the obligation to explain why it didn't follow advice, and when it is not necessary. That's basically, I think, the best discussion point.
Thank you, Bertrand. European Commission.
Thank you, yes, and I think we probably all want to avoid turning this into a working group on redrafting the bylaws. But just to make a couple of observations, our problem is essentially that the bylaws just says the GAC gives advice, full stop. It doesn't say the GAC can give advice or opinions or offer, information or anything. It says we give advice. And you're right, and we can argue that thanking the hosts actually in our communique for hosting the meeting isn't advice to ICANN to change its policies. But I'll be frank, I was one of those people that was a bit frustrated actually by this kind of response, because I think a heavy application of common sense actually would have suggested that when we take a position on a policy issue and we take the trouble to discuss it and to communicate it to the board in writing, that we have assumed that that's GAC advice. So I think the problem actually is we didn't write the bylaws, I'll be frank, and we have no power to change them. That's your job up there, actually. And that's why some of us were a bit surprised that it's taken so long for you to indicate that you weren't sure what was GAC advice. I mean, maybe we should have checked, but I think we'd been acting in good faith that you would have told us, if you weren't sure, that what we were communicating to you should be considered as advice. So I hope you'll take that in the constructive spirit that it's meant. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Senegal.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Maimouna Diop. I'm representative of Senegal on the GAC and one of the GAC vice chair. I just want to add on the report done by Heather that we also have small discussion about the advice we give to the ICANN board, and if they don't take it in account, they have to give to the GAC back the reason why they did not take these advice into account.
Thank you, Maimouna.
I always love some of these discussions at ICANN, and I guess this seems somewhat surreal to me that we're talking about what is advice, because I guess I'm kind of with you that if the GAC sends us a letter, I would assume that means that they're behind it and that's their advice. So I guess the question I have, Peter, is has ICANN ever received something in writing from the GAC that the GAC did not consider advice?
Well, I think probably the more important point, and let's finish this, is to say that I'm pretty sure that, as Bill said, that strong dollops of common sense have been applied. And as far as I can tell, and we've never had any communication to the contrary, there isn't any incident where advice, what's been regarded as advice by you, has been received by us and not followed. I'm not aware of any circumstance where there's been a suggestion that the mediation process should have been activated. So it's sort of a discussion really without, it seems to me, any practical consequences. Let's fix it by all means, but unless the GAC is suggesting that because of this there's a great stack of advice sitting in a bucket somewhere that's not been followed, I'm not quite sure whether we should spend much more time on it.
Okay, thank you, Peter. If by any chance board is considering to change or propose changes in bylaws in relation to the GAC advice, in our discussions here, what transpired that according to current bylaws, GAC provides advice exclusively to the board. In practice, GAC interacts with the supporting organizations at the early stage of policy development. And according to bylaws, all GAC communication goes up to the board and then hopefully down from the board to a supporting organization in question. So maybe it makes sense to examine and consider whether that is feasible, that GAC interacts not only with the board but also with supporting organizations if GAC is asked to participate in the policy development process from the public policy perspective. This is what was discussed during these conversations. So I have U.S., Canada, and then Rita. So United States.
Thank you. I thought it might be worthwhile then to chime in and share a bit of the discussion that the GAC had with the accountability review team, because actually a question was put to us whether we could think of an occasion where we had developed what we consider to be fairly strong advice that had not been taken into account and that we hadn't actually had an opportunity to discuss that with the board. And we did come up with an example, so I'm happy to share it with you. You might find that helpful. In March 2007, the GAC completed its principles on the introduction of new GTLDs. And it's our understanding, if I have the dates right, it was June 2008, that the board adopted the GNSO recommendations on new GTLDs. To our knowledge, there was never a side-by-side comparison or analysis done. And ever since that time, I believe the GAC has come back in many communiques and a few discrete letters, but primarily communiques, to highlight where there has been a discrepancy. So I do think that is a fair example where the GAC actually was ahead of the game. We issued advice, and as Yanis pointed out, one of the challenges we have is that under the bylaws, our advice goes to the board. We, of course, do share our communiques with the rest of the community. We do engage and interact with them. But in all fairness to the other SOs and ACs, they are not under any obligation to listen to the GAC. So it is only the board that has a bylaws obligation to accept GAC advice. So that is the challenge. It goes one way. Thank you.
Thanks, Suzanne. I think probably our reaction to that is that we don't regard the implementation process in relation to GTLDs finished, and that we are constantly taking GAC advice into account as we are moving through developing the GAC, developing the bylaws. And perhaps the most recent example is in relation to some geographic names, for example. And so when we're going through these processes, I can assure you Yanis is sitting there as the guardian of the GAC principles, and when we're discussing a particular process, as well as the staff advice that comes to us that says, hang on, there's a GAC principle on this, Yanis is there, you know, defending that. So I'm not sure what you think we haven't done. If there's an area in relation to the GTLD implementation program that is currently in conflict with GAC, the GAC principles that you gave, then we should deal with that. But I don't think it's an example where advice was given and has been ignored. We rather see it as GAC advice, and we are still, with the DAG 4, processing how we can take account of that advice.
So, Rita?
Thanks, Suzanne. That actually was helpful. I was going to say before your comments that maybe we should just take on board that communique equals advice, and maybe that will solve part of the problem, which, again, to your point, EU. I think that's common sense, but I don't actually think that that's acceptable if we have, in fact, received something from the GAC that you all don't feel was addressed properly, and I think we should, as the board, work to fix that. So I'm sorry if that's been the case, because that doesn't seem acceptable to me.
Thank you. Heather, Canada.
I would just note that in the relevant bylaw, it seems to focus on whether the board takes an action that is consistent or inconsistent, and we seem to be using the word conflict. Whether there are two relevant bylaws, but I think that might also be helpful to us if we think about the word consistency. I wanted to provide a slightly different example, and this I think speaks to why we're recommending the creation of a register. You may be aware that the GAC has issued, in fact, two principles documents related to country codes, and replaced, in effect, the first one with a second updated version in 2005. And it came to our attention that the understanding at the board and by staff working in IANA was that there was only one version, the first version, and that's what they were referencing. And so in creating a register, we would hope that that would not happen in the future. And, of course, we also recommend that we try to notate our advice more consistently. So perhaps if we would have written on it, this replaces the earlier version, it would have been made more clear. But I think that's also quite a critical issue for the GAC, and so I would highlight that as well to the board.
Thank you, Heather. Bruce Tompkin.
Thank you. Yeah, is this working? Hopefully
it's working.
I just wanted to follow up what the representative from the US government pointed out with respect to the process with the GAC advice on new GTLDs and how that had been handled. And it also relates to something that came up in the affirmation of commitments review team yesterday, and that's about explaining reasons why a particular position wasn't accepted. And I think if you look at the GNSO process and if you look at the board process, a lot of the effort is put into getting consensus around a set of principles or a set of recommendations, and then most of the documentation is about supporting why they supported those recommendations. And ICANN as a culture doesn't tend to document very much the reason against a particular position. So that advice from the GAC on geographic names in the GNSO, because I chaired that committee at the time, resulted in a working group being formed, and there was a geographic names working group, if I remember correctly, or it might have been under reserve names working group, but there was a working group where that was considered and discussed. But it didn't sort of come back with a formal response back to the GAC saying, we've taken your advice, we've considered it in this way, and this is why we've accepted or rejected it. So that didn't happen at the GNSO level, and that's the level where you're going to have the people that really understand the issues. Then by the time it gets to the board's a governance body, and I think what we have to do to improve the process is further down at the GNSO or CCNSO level, that's the first point where if the GAC advice is received at that point, there is a formal response to that advice written as part of the GNSO process, and then that advice is then available for the board as well, rather than trying to get the board to craft such advice, because the board members, by and large, you know, there's only two on the board that know GNSO issues in any detail, and the others are more generalists. So I think the key thing from a bylaws perspective is requiring as an improvement that whether it's from the GAC or ALAC or SSAC or RSAC, any of the advisory committees that provide advice, that the relevant policy body, whether it's GNSO or CCNSO or ASO, formally responds to that advice at that point, and then the board can then consider it if that response isn't deemed to be acceptable. So I just want to think we've got to sort of start getting it to work bottom up, not waiting till it gets to the board and asking, you know, 18 of the board members that don't know that issue in depth to try and respond as to why your advice wasn't accepted.
Thank you, Bruce. Rob?
Yes, I just wanted to respond to the vice chairperson from Canada's suggestion with respect to a register, or I guess it's the joint working group recommendation. It sounds like an excellent sound recommendation. I mean, we need to have that data there for accountability and transparency. And I would just like to mention we've developed that similar register for the history of all the board resolutions that was posted this week. And we'll just say we'd very much like to work with you and get your feedback on that register and see if you'd like us to build something like that to support you, unless you'd rather do the register in a different, you know, in your own website or a different place. We'd be very happy on the staff side to support that execution.
Thank you, Rod. Norway?
Yes, thank you, Anis. And I just want to also just briefly comment on what Susanne was saying. When we made the principles in March 2007, and of course not getting a response, then of course that appears to the GAC that the advice has been ignored. And of course making a register would make that, of course, easier if, like, advice on that, maybe it's pending, for example, then, of course, you're still evaluating and so on. But still, that could make it more easy to accommodate and to track what advice we have been given. But I also want to just add up and under the comments on that it is a bit surprising that sort of the assumption of the communication from the GAC is not sort of being considered as GAC advice in the past. But just, I also wanted to make a positive comment as well, especially on these country of territory names. And I think I must commend the ICANN board for making this appear in the DAG version 4, that the country and territory names are not treated as GTLDs. And I think also I want to comment that, of course, I would say the sensible solution is not to just delay it until the first round, but to delay taking applications on that until the PDP, the CCPDP, has been established, and not just the first round of the GTLDs. So thanks. And very quick, which is also related to the GAC advice, is also the post-delegation procedures that you also have taken on board. And I think that's also a good example that you are making a mechanism that will actually allow some governments to be able to give approval or non-objection to some new GTLDs, for example, for city names. So that is good. So I just want to commend on that as well. But still, there are some issues to be resolved. Thanks.
Thank you, Arnulf. Peter?
Just to be clear, I don't think I said or meant that just because it was in a communique, it was not treated as advice. In fact, if you take the example of the XXX application, the primary pieces of GAC advice in relation to XXX from memory come from the communiques, the Wellington communique in 2006 and the Lisbon communique. And they've been carefully looked at in relation to that XXX decision. So rest assured, communiques, when they in relation to, and this is the dose of common sense that Bill says we should apply, and I said, that we mostly do. I wonder if we can move off advice and let's see the report and let's carry on the discussion and take up another one of the suggestions, and then that's the question of the notification to the GAC of public policy positions. And that was first formally raised in a letter just from Yanis to me, and I can't remember the exact issue. What we've done, I think it was the EOI letter, that was the first time the current practice has ever been raised and questioned, and that practice has been that because Yanis is because the chairman of the GAC, and there's been others before Yanis, and in fact I see one of them is actually another one's in the room. Paul Toomey has visited us. We've had this long practice of having the GAC chair acting as liaison to the board and participates in all of the board discussions, and that's been regarded as a satisfactory way of communicating. Now, if that's not, we've got no difficulty at all with creating a more formal notification process, providing a list of active areas of policy development or a list of here's the board agenda. You know, we can develop something. So I don't think it's led to problems. It seems to have been a relatively effective practical thing. But if more formality is required, there's absolutely no objection to that.
Thank you, Peter. Though I think that this discussion revealed that there might be a possibility, or when board will decide to change or amend bylaws, to take into account the substance of the discussion and see whether this vertical communication GAC board is only a possible way according to bylaws to provide public policy advice. Maybe it could be somehow changed and formalized that GAC advice is also considered in supporting organizations during the policy development process.
Well, let me foreshadow an immediate and enormous political problem with that, and that is that the situation has resulted. The current structure is a very delicate balance between all of the different stakeholders and the balancing of interests. The suggestion that GAC advice, when given to an SO, also carries with it the same power and obligation would be a very significant reweighting of the political balancing exercise that the current structure recommends. If you're going to go into the registrar constituency talking about renegotiating the RAA and governmental advisory committee advice in a registry constituency is also going to have to be followed, you're talking about an incredible extension of the power of the GAC. And so that may be something that the community will accept, but my suggestion is that would take a lot of discussion.
So then let's keep thinking about that. Shall we move then to the next agenda item on our of today's? Dennis, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Yanis. Has the board GAC working group considered the question of intersessional advice? Now, I know that the GAC works tremendously hard, and I understand that the GAC advice comes from the meetings of the GAC at the public meetings, but I'm just asking because I can envisage situations where the GAC may wish to respond rapidly to an emerging situation on a timescale that the next planned meeting doesn't accommodate. So I just wonder whether the working group has considered the question of intersessional advice, urgent advice, whatever you want to call it.
Heather?
The current draft that we have does recognize that iterative policy development process and that advice can be given in stages. So it's not explicit, but there is, I guess, an implicit understanding there that the GAC at least may have various degrees of advice in terms of time. I think there are examples of the GAC providing advice intersessionally because we have issued letters, for example, intersessionally. But within the working group, which is, you know, what I would prefer to speak to and defer to other colleagues, whether they would want to comment more broadly, we intend to have a final report in Cartagena, so there is time, there is opportunity for the joint working group to consider that question and perhaps elaborate further on that matter. So.
Thank you, Heather. In practical terms, that means in the past when GAC has issued a letter containing public policy advice intersessionally, then during the next face-to-face meeting, the GAC revisited the text and formally endorsed during the face-to-face meeting, and that found reflection in the GAC communique. So that has been used in the past. So let us move Pakistan.
Thank you. A very quick one regarding the comment Mr. President made about disruption of the balance, if a delicate balance, if more weight was given to GAC advice. I would just like to remind that this whole process started in WSIS in Geneva in 2003, and it was the governments that were really most concerned about the having a more democratic system for the governance of the internet, and so much so that it was so contentious that we could not resolve the issue in Geneva, and it carried forward to Tunis, and finally in Tunis the outcomes were the Internet Governance Forum and the GAC, if I'm not wrong. So I and how things evolved and how this balance was created, but I think governments were at the forefront that were asking for a more a bigger share in the governance of the internet. So I just wanted to bring that data to the table. I mean, however we resolve it, it's not going to be done in this one meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. In fact, this has resulted with the IGF and the concept of the enhanced cooperation. GAC was created with together with creation of ICANN about 10 years ago, now more, and existed since then. So, New Zealand.
Yeah, thank you, Anas. Just a point about the question of balance and advice to the supporting organisations. I think it's worth pointing out, Peter, that rather than changing the balance, one of the issues that's coming out of the joint working group, as I understand it, is the need for GAC influence on early parts of the policy development process, and that has not been that's been perceived as being something of a failure. Now, an example where early involvement has worked supremely well is in the case of the fast-track IDNs, where there's very, very close working relationship between the CCNSO and the GAC, and it's worked brilliantly well. And an area where it's tended to break down has been in terms of the generic, the new generics, top-level domains, where it has not worked so well. So it's in that context this has got to be looked at. It's not really a matter of changing balance. It's a matter of ensuring that the GAC is involved at an early stage in policy development, which leads to much better outcomes. And that's really the point that's being made, I think.
Can I just very quickly agree with that point? I think the cases where the GAC has gone out and participated early in those processes have been very, very successful. I'm completely in favour of that.
Bertrand, Franz.
Without continuing this discussion too long, because we have the working group and it will develop, just to reinforce what Frank was saying, Peter, I do not think that it changes anything in terms of balance, because if a constituency or any part of the GNSO elaborates a position that goes to the GNSO Council, that then goes to the board, and if at that stage the GAC gives an advice to the board that is in contradiction or says that what is being proposed is not okay, it is exactly the same thing as if we had introduced the same comment earlier, and according to Frank, this would have been much more efficient. So I do not think that establishing any kind of circulation of direct information to the policy development process at an earlier stage would in any dimension change the balance of power, so it shouldn't be considered as an obstacle.
Let me agree with that as well, that I'm not talking about preventing what you just called the circulation of direct information to the policy process. I completely agree with that.
I think that this makes a good segue to the next question we have in mind to discuss. That is a question which in other words is known as MOPO, Morality and Public Order. We came up with this abbreviation during the meeting, and it seems that the community really liked that abbreviation, MOPO. We had already a very extensive discussion about that among ourselves, and I would like to ask Suzanne introduce the question, and especially from this perspective of the GAC advice given earlier or taken into account at the early stage of policy development. Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Yanis. I'm happy to do that, and I know that many of my colleagues, in fact, a majority of GAC members around the table, have views on this as well, so hopefully we will have sufficient time to address them all. On this issue, actually, I believe the GAC anticipated in its March 2007 new GTLD principles, we anticipated what I think MOPO is intended to address, but we used different terminology. And we cautioned the ICANN board that we anticipated that with the introduction of new generic top-level domains, there was a strong possibility that there could be terms that would be proposed that would raise national religious, cultural, linguistic sensitivities. So I believe that was the terminology we used, sort of saying, look, we know this is possible and we urge great caution as you move ahead. I don't exactly recall when MOPO first sort of hit the screen, DAG 2 or 3. It certainly was in V3. We really, that was the first time we all tried to understand the process, and I believe we flagged our concerns and questions about it on numerous occasions in our exchanges. So I certainly remember at least going back to Sydney and probably even before. In April of this year, Yiannis arranged, and Kurt Pritz very graciously agreed to a GAC conference briefing and an exchange on this issue. And the GAC had sent him probably way too many questions, I think 9 or 10 or so. And we had a very good exchange, and yet I will say, despite his best efforts, and he did make best efforts, if Kurt is in the room, thank you again, the majority of us came away from that call feeling as though none of the questions had been answered. So we went back to the drawing board. We in Washington very, very definitely went back to the drawing board trying to figure out, can we fix this since we can't answer these questions, or can we come up with an alternative? And after extensive discussions and a lot of analysis, I think we identified what we believe is the threshold problem with MOPO as proposed, that the morality and public order terminology is lifted out of a treaty, Treaty of Paris, and is used in that treaty as the basis upon which countries, the signatories, can take an exemption. And the exemption is you would deny a trademark application on the grounds that it raised, quote, morality and public order problems or concerns in your country. So, number one, it's the basis for an exemption. And number two, the exemptions are left to each sovereign country to determine how they would apply them. So the more we thought about this, we decided that that was in the inherent flaw in the ICANN-MOPO proposed approach, that you're using the basis for an exemption in a treaty that governments take as the, you're flipping it to become a positive foundation upon which panels of, forgive me, so-called international juridical experts will make decisions. And I believe the language is used, you know, based on agreed definitions in international law. Well, from the GAC's perspective, there are no formally agreed international definitions of morality and public order. And the Treaty of Paris enshrines that and underscores that by saying each country can take an exemption from these treaty provisions based on their own national interpretation of those terms. So there is a great deal of respect in that treaty for differences among nations as to how they might define what could be objectionable on morality and public order grounds. So actually, we've kind of come to the point and had a very, very extensive discussion this morning around the GAC table and then subsequently between the GAC and the ALAC on the same issue that, frankly, we think it is rather unworkable. In fact, I shouldn't say rather. Am I being too polite? We think it is completely unworkable. Thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne. I think that we used an example of issue which everybody considers as a bad child pornography. And we could try to prevent names alluding to child pornography by applying to the Convention of the Protection of the Rights of the Child. But the problem is that this is not a universal instrument. Not all countries have are state parties to Convention of the Rights of the Child. And how then a provision which is not binding to a state could be applied to that state? So you see that there is a problem that in an international arena there are a number of international treaties which could be used to to underscore these issues or use to justify a kind of action based on morality and public order. But the problem is that these legal instruments are not universal, or not yet universal. So, and therefore, that creates a problem in a number of countries. This is just an illustration of a real situation with the international instruments, legal instruments. So, any other comments?
I had lots of questions about that, but I suppose the simplest question is, does the GAC have a view of its own then as to how we should follow GAC Principle 2.1, which is that new GTLD should respect sensitivities regarding terms with national, etc. significance? How do you think we should create a system that takes account of the sensitivities of national, cultural and religious significant names? Give us some advice on how this might look if you don't like the way we're suggesting.
So I must tell you, Peter, we had this discussion, and we're trying intensively, seeking all possible or examining all possible options and solutions. And I must tell you, for the time being, we do not arrive to the point which we would consider being a workable and good alternative. The point of this discussion is to raise awareness that the GAC believes that this is a not workable proposal. And we commit ourselves to further reflect on this issue, and hopefully in no time we will come up with something workable.
The other part of that, of course, is please can we have a very clear exposition from you in terms of advice as to what you think is wrong with the current proposal.
Bruce.
Thank you, Yanis. I just wanted to provide, I guess, at least the interpretation the GNSO had at the time on the text, and I accept you've got a different interpretation. But firstly, just on the topic of the terminology international law, we recognise that there is no such thing as international law. There's various treaties, and then different governments or nations then decide to encapsulate some of those treaties into their national laws. And international treaties aren't necessarily signed by all countries, was our advice at the time. So what we tried to do was identify the existence of some international treaties, and I believe there was, and I may not be getting the wording right, but I thought there were some treaties that covered things like racial discrimination, covered things such as protecting the rights of children and things. So we tried to name some treaties that we'd asked the staff to give us advice on, and we named some treaties. Now, we recognise that those treaties aren't necessarily then represented in national law, but that's why we use the terminology international norms. We sort of thought, if there is an international treaty, and let's say 50 out of 200 countries signed it, then that was kind of what we were referring to as saying that's a reasonable international norm that ICANN could use as a basis for rejecting a particular application. So that was our intent. And really what we're sort of seeking is the GNSO back, and you remember, Suzanne, at the early days, we actually asked the GAC to give us some advice. Now, that was done verbally in meetings such as this, where we did seek guidance. We didn't receive any guidance from the GAC, and so the GNSO worked with the staff, and the staff had suggested that as a compromise position. Now, it was very controversial in the GNSO. Many hours were devoted to that, and it wasn't unanimous in the GNSO in accepting it. It was a two-thirds majority around that language, but really it was a two-thirds majority saying we recognise we need some mechanism that dealt with the original GAC principle, and that was the mechanism we came up with in the absence of any advice on a mechanism. So really all I can say is what Peter said is what we really need is advice from the GAC on how to make your GAC principle work in practice.
Thank you, Bruce. Bertrand, Franz.
Just quickly, this is not about fundamentally the GAC alone defining a procedure to solve this problem. The outcome of our discussion, both inside the GAC and then in interaction with ALAC was actually to push unanimously for a debate or a discussion within the community among the different stakeholders to find a solution to this. I won't get into details. A few possible orientations have been explored, and honestly, the discussion this morning has been absolutely excellent. The only thing that I think Suzanne was raising is that it is only basically in Nairobi, as a result actually of a GAC-ALAC interaction in the previous meeting, that the two advisory committees just raised the level of awareness and attention to this topic that had not really been paid attention enough to. And so now we're confronted with a situation where there is an issue, and I think the discussion today was very heartwarming in terms of the interaction between the actors of the community, and we'll probably have a joint group to discuss possible solutions.
Thanks. Just a question, I guess, for Suzanne. I know this may not be, you may not be championing this particular position, but I just want to make sure I understand it. The suggestion is that the problem with using treaties, as Bruce has said, which establish international norms, is that there are some countries who haven't signed those treaties. So what that means is if under one of those treaties a name would be banned, there would be people in some countries who would regard that as improper because they live in a country where that conduct is not banned. And what that means is that they should be allowed to use that name, but that's completely inconsistent with the GAC principle, which says that, one, we have to take account of those sensitivities. So what's wrong with us taking the position that if there is an international norm, and many countries, if not all, have acceded to it, that the way of taking into account those sensitivities is to stop it? I understand that there would be some people in some countries who would feel that if the rules were made in their country, that that would be allowed. But under this principle, names are prevented. And they're prevented because they're offensive to a large number of people. They're offensive to all of those people who've signed the treaty and made that conduct, banned conduct. So I find it really inconsistent that you're arguing that we have to have a system that recognises sensitivity but at the same time allows people to proceed in a way that is insensitive. So help me through that conundrum, please.
Suzanne?
Well, of course, knowing that I am not an attorney and I'm speaking to several attorneys, I will do my best. I think the problem we have, and again, thank you, Bruce, for reminding me that you all worked very, very hard, and apologies if the GAC was ever approached with a request for advice, because I don't think we ever felt we were invited to come into the GNSO and help work on this, so my apologies for that. That's many, many years ago. And again, not to suggest that the GNSO was not very, very well-intentioned, trying to find a proposed mechanism to deal with these kinds of issues. The problem presented to all of us by this particular choice of terminology is that it is taken from a particular treaty that is, and again, I'm not the lawyer here, so you can correct me, that countries have signed, and it provides the basis upon which those countries can take an exemption from the provisions of the treaty that they otherwise have committed to be bound by. Okay? So you're flipping the basis for an exemption, and the reason it's an exemption and the reason the terms are used that way is that each country has the sovereign right to define morality and public order for itself. So there is no international norm. That is our problem. So each country still retains the right, in the GAC's mind, of defining what it finds objectionable on those grounds. And your proposed approach, regrettably, does not lead us to a new international standard that we could all say, wow, this looks very interesting. That is the problem. Now, a related problem, but it's very small, and we do need to do a lot more work on this, in really examining how MOPO is intended to work, it could very well be that some of the sensitivities that the GAC tried to highlight way back when, at a rather high level, would not even be captured by the MOPO approach. Some terms, let's say names of religions, would conceivably not be captured by MOPO. However, there would be a lot of people who might feel very, very strongly, not just about the string, but about the entity that is applying for it. Is that the relevant entity or the appropriate entity or the authorized entity, whatever, however you wish to characterize it, that should in fact get the string for, I don't know, dot Catholic? So there are those other sensitivities that would not at all be captured by this phrase, morality and public order, just by way of example. We did have a very good exchange. My colleagues must be getting tired at the end of the day because they were much more spirited earlier today. I wish I had a video camera and you could have seen it. And certainly our exchange with the ALAC, and one idea that we have surfaced that obviously we need to do a little bit more work on is to work on this jointly, have a broader kind of community-wide approach, because clearly everybody cares about this and you want it to work well. And so we're working through how to make that proposal, how to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Suzanne,
I'm sure they're quiet because you're doing such an excellent job of representing their...
So, in absence of further comments, we are just flagging that there is, in our view, that there is a problem we need to continue thinking about and come up with a kind of solution. I would like to see whether there would be another request for the floor, and I see Dennis.
I'm just a bit worried about this. We all take this very seriously. We're all very concerned about it. We thought we had a framework of dealing with this, and it's not yet advice, but what I hear is that the advice will be that this is inadequate. But we then urgently need an alternative, and I know you're working on it, but it's a very complex issue, and I suppose my instinct to say, is there anything we can do to help to your work in this area? Because we are, well, certainly I am, it doesn't speak for us collectively, I am certainly bothered by this, and we don't want to make a major mistake in this area. So is there some way that we can facilitate or assist? I can.
European Commission, Bildi.
Thank you. I don't want Suzanne to think that we're enjoying her show too much, although I think we were quiet because we were quite happy with what you said. Yes, I think this is a very serious matter, Dennis. The observation I'd make, and I don't know whether you'll enjoy this very much, but I think it comes back to the role of the GAC within ICANN. We're an advisory committee. We give advice to private sector corporations that's orientated along private sector-led grounds. We're giving advice that this is unworkable in our opinion. The bylaws don't say that we give advice only in the instances where we also come with an alternative solution. We've reached a stage where we've said this we think is unworkable for us. We're quite happy, I think you've heard actually, we're quite happy to take part in discussions with other members of the ICANN community to try and find a solution, but I would resist the idea that the responsibility for finding a solution is ours. We're plainly telling you this doesn't work from our perspective, and that's the advice we're going to give you. In an ideal world, of course, actually, there'd be a fiche behind that with the solution that we found for you. But on this one, there isn't at the moment, but we are quite willing to work. But I think we should flag that I personally don't feel the GAC should accept responsibility for finding a solution. You know, we have a private corporation which we're all here to support. The supporting organizations, correct me if I'm wrong, are responsible for proposing the policies. The board are responsible for agreeing to them. The staff for executing them. Our role is to give advice on public policy. And I think Suzanne, in a very articulate manner, has explained to you where we are at the moment. And we are. I think there's a great desire this morning, actually, to participate, because we know that we're part of the problem here, and having identified this. But I just put a marker down, actually, that I wouldn't raise expectations, Dennis, that you I take your offer very generously. But is there something you can do to help us? Sounds very much to me as though you think that this is a problem we have to sort out, whereas I think it's a problem you have to sort out. Thank you.
I think Harold is seeking the floor.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify the definition of unworkable. I mean, this definition has possibly been the most attacked one I've seen in the guidebook. And one group has attacked it because it permits the blocking of too many strings. Another group has attacked it because it permits the blocking of too few strings. I understand, but I might misunderstand your statement as saying that you are attacking it as unworkable because it blocks too few strings. I would just like to verify that.
Please, Suzanne.
Actually, that was not my intention at all. We're talking about the methodology that is proposed. So we're actually challenging the whole fundamental premise that you can arrive at a decision based on terms that are currently defined on a country-by-country basis, on, as the basis for exceptions. So it seems just bizarre that you would somehow be able to turn those terms around to create a basis for making an affirmative decision. That is the fundamental problem. I won't even get into the challenges I've encountered in literally trying to describe for my political management how these three, maybe multiple panels of three people, none of whom have ever been identified, will actually arrive at their decisions. So there are, I cannot tell you how many layers there are of challenges for us, but the first one is this threshold problem.
Thank you. So that creates a real problem for me, because I don't understand the purpose of the process in that some of the examples given, like the religious group, I thought that was a completely different part of the guidebook. It was community objection. So this thing we're talking about was entitled Morality and Public Order. And the corporation was challenged to come up with some definition that was actually possible to exercise in practice, and has come up to us with a suggestion and has been told that this is unworkable. And I'm still, from the engineering viewpoint, is that okay, the output of a process that looks like this is going to have a certain shape. Since the process is wrong, the output must be wrong. Otherwise, you couldn't tell that it was wrong. So the output must have a different shape. And I'm trying to figure out what output you're aiming for as a result of having the morality and public order objection in the process. And I had a hard time following the definition of positive, negative, and so on, because this is, of course, this is after all a procedure that can only result in a denial. So we have a terminology problem to sort through, but I would also like to focus on what is the output of the process that we are trying to achieve.
Thank you, Harold. Portugal.
Well, this is an issue that that must actually be looked at from several angles, so we should not oversimplify it, I think. But leaving to the side a formal treatment, a fit, and a practical solution at the moment, I think I just like to phrase a concern that some of us around the table have that may highlight where problems might appear that somehow raise difficulties. If somehow on the process of approving new GTLDs, some of them are approved which are against the law of a particular country, that may raise the possibility of fragmentation of access to certain of these domains. And we think that we should do our best to avoid that kind of situation. And that's why this sentence, formulated in this form, that of course can account for many different things, also is related to worries like this.
Thank you. I have Ray, Rita, and then Bertrand in line.
Thank you, Yanis. It seems to me that, yes, I understand hesitancy to be the person that's, the GAC being the person to propose the solution. However, because of the fact that you're voicing objections, it would seem to me, in order to be part of the solution, that perhaps you could provide some characterization of the framework of what could be a workable solution. And so instead of using the terms about things being unworkable or bizarre or so forth, what are some things that possibly could characterize the work that would have to be done to come up with a solution?
Thank you, Ray. We will try to do our best. Rita.
Thanks, Yanis. I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to go to the discussions this morning, Suzanne and others, because I have to say that I've not liked this formulation, morality and public order, since I first read it, and I understand that it was a compromise, as Bruce mentioned, in the GNSO, because there were some concerns about doing a dot Catholic, to use your example, and having the wrong organization get it, or doing something about, you know, the way women should dress in certain countries that don't want to have that information disseminated. I mean, there's a ton of different examples we can give here. Even if we look at the XXX example, there's you know, people around the world that would have different views on whether that's against morality and public order. I think you add that the layer of trademark law, which is this treaty you're talking about, right? And trademarks are necessarily national in nature. So what does that mean? Each country can decide certain rules around trademarks. So I feel your pain here, and I think that what I'm hearing, at least, and I'm talking as much to the board here, what I'm hearing the GAC say is that we were saying, or the GNSO was saying, there's this international standard, and there really isn't, because this treaty allows the countries to say, we decide morality and public order. And the gentleman from Portugal, I'm sorry, I think it was Portugal, has stated exactly what has been my fear all along, is that I don't want to start a TLD that people are going to start blocking. I really don't, because I think that's what makes the internet great, and I want people all over the world to be able to have as much information as they can. You know, so I think this is a mutual problem. This was in the GNSO policy. I think we all need to figure out how to solve this. It's not about saying, you know, you do this or you do this. I hope we can all try to figure this really, really difficult and serious problem out together.
Thank you, Rita. Bertrand, Franz.
One of the challenges that we have now is to actually render in a short period of time an extremely dense discussion that took 2.5 hours this morning, and we have progress during that time. I think Harald is right in explaining that the formulation that was actually adopted not by the GNSO, but by the staff as a proposal to implement the GNSO recommendation, which is an important distinction. What we're talking about is a mechanism and not only the recommendation itself. You're absolutely right, Harald, to say some say it allows to block too many and others say it allows to block too few. However, I would caution against a natural tendency sometimes in ICANN that says if we manage to make two parties uncomfortable, this means we're right in the middle place. Because actually the problem is orthogonal. Those two parties are right. In a certain way, the current formulation is allowing too many blocking and not enough for other actors. which means that it is unworkable because if it is implemented as such, it will cause problems in the implementation. I think I would fully support, and it was actually a main outcome of the discussion this morning, what Rita said is we have a common goal, and this was really clearly emerging. We want to make sure that there is a process that, as much as possible, ensures that any string that is inserted in the root will be acceptable worldwide so that no country is going to block it. But this raises a concern. However, there is no treaty, even those that have been mentioned before, that says anything about a word being unacceptable. Treaties are about behaviors. And so a TLD string is a label. What is behind is the content. And we are, without getting into details, because actually it was part of the discussion this morning, mutatis mutandis, the problem we are having here with the top-level space is an equivalent to the problems we're facing regarding blocking on globally hosted content platforms. The objective is to have the TLDs accepted in as not only as many, but ideally all countries, so that there is no blocking of a TLD, which would be a real problem. And that at the same time, the content that is objectionable at a lower level is being monitored or filtered according to national law at the most granular level. Without getting into details, I want to recall that the word morality and public order is not only present in the Treaty of Paris, it is also in Article 29 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And one of the tracks that we've been exploring this morning, without getting into details, is that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has a very careful balance between Article 19 and Article 29, and there probably is some inspiration there that could be used to try to find a model or a solution. But clearly, it is a matter for the community to discuss, and the GAC has said clearly this morning, with ALAC and with any other entity that wants it, that we're willing to participate in a group to find a solution.
Thank you, Bertrand. Dennis?
Thank you, Yanis. Perhaps naively, but I had thought or hoped that the objection process would be a sufficient safeguard in relation to the morality and public order issues. And I wonder, has that been discussed by the GAC? And if it has, in what regard is the objection process inadequate to deal with strings that might get through the our version of the filter for morality and public order?
While we're thinking the answer, Gonzalo.
Thank you, Janice. Just a quick comment. Totally, I will agree with my colleague, Dennis. We are talking about here about content and processes too. So there is such a thing. There are human rights, and international human rights, and for many countries, one thing could be really, really dangerous or forbidden or I don't know, problematic. But for other countries, no. And within the human rights, there is such a thing called freedom of speech. Maybe someone is going to be interested, you know, to defend a position within the process. So what we need to be sure or to ensure during that process is due process, exactly. That's the word or the concept. So we have to try to add balance to each involved or interested party to have enough space and opportunities to defend their rights. Thank you, I think.
Thank you, Gonzalo. Peter?
Thank you very much. I think this is a tremendously interesting discussion. Perhaps we can start to wrap it up a little bit. I'm very glad there was eventually agreement, I think, that there's an inconsistent call for too much regulation and then too few. The first one was in relation to the treaty situation. those countries who don't sign the treaty don't want to be bound. But on the other hand, the call for control of .Catholic means that you want stronger. So I think it's important to recognise that that's an inconsistent call, some for too few and some for too many. The other thing that I think we have to be very careful about, which is the fragmentation issue, the worst consequence of following that path is to allow every country an absolute veto power on what goes into the route. If the idea is that fragmentation has to be prevented at all costs, it means that you give every country the total veto power of what goes into the route. And I don't think that's an acceptable solution for the majority of users. And finally, I think we've circled right back with Bill, some of Bill Lee's comments on the thing we started with before, which is what is the nature of advice from the GAC? And it would be very distressing to me if advice from the GAC was purely limited to what looks rather like judgment, telling us that what we've proposed is unworkable, is a form of advice, but it looks much like judgment. And when we ask, well, give us advice on how you can make this work, that there's some resistance to giving us that advice. Advice has to be advice, and if we ask for it, it doesn't make it any less advice. So we look forward to advice from the GAC as to how we can make your requirements or your conditions workable. How can we create a situation where TLDs will be granted that take into account the sensitivities that you've asked us to take into account? We look forward to that advice with real interest. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. And I think that the thrust of this discussion, or throughout this discussion, it was made very clear that we're not sitting with our hands in the lap and just waiting for the solution. We're actively seeking solution, and we certainly spare no efforts to continue seeking the solution, and once it will be found, we will be communicating. We are slightly over the time which is allocated to the session, and I know that there is one. The delegation of Brazil is willing to make a brief statement, which would be qualified under any other business. Delegation of Brazil.
Thank you, Janice. A very brief statement. In the context of the IDN fast track process, we believe that is being driven in a very successful basis. Brazil would like to express its support to the recent board's decision about avoiding graphic similitude between new country codes and current country codes in Latin. This is particularly important in as much as any graphic confusion might facilitate phishing practices and all the problems related to it. So we would like to express publicly our support to the board's attitude about taking into consideration this particular aspect in the IDN's current implementation process. Thank you.
Thank you, Brazil. Peter, you had something in mind?
Yes, just a quick item in response to GAC advice. You asked us some time ago to conduct a series of studies in relation to who is. And I've previously reported on that. There was, for example, a study published on February the 15th and a final report, and that was on who is accuracy. And that's budgeted to cost $210,000. In addition to that, the questions that you asked were, as you remember, forwarded to the GNSO, who have reformulated those questions into four distinct classes of who is studies. One of them is who is misuse, and another one is who is registry and identification, and feasibility and costing studies have you done in relation to those, and $400,000 has been budgeted for conducting those studies. There are two remaining in the group, who is proxy and privacy services abuse, and who is proxy and privacy services reveal studies. They are yet to be feasibility and cost studies yet to be done, the feasibility analysis and costing, but it's expected that something of the order of 400,000 will be done in relation to those studies. So I just offer that as an indication of the work that's going on in response to a GAC request.
Thank you, Peter. This is very much appreciated, and So that seems to me that brings us to the end of this session. And in absence of further requests for the floor, it remains to me to thank the board for active participation. I hope that this conversation brought us closer to a better understanding of each other's position. And as I said earlier, we will be seeking further solutions to the questions we have discussed here. Thank you very much indeed. And see you next time under new chairmanship from the GAC side.
Thank you.